This edition of The Review was first broadcast on the 28th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of The Review here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Gillian DeBias. On this week's show, we're looking back at the very best of The Review from 2013, revisiting some of our favourite highlights from the last 12 months. We'll be getting involved in some heated debate.
I'm all on for haute bourgeois parties, and I go to a lot of them, and I didn't get enough of it from this exhibition, which seemed sort of billed as a blockbuster, but seemed rather thin.
And we'll be reviving some of our favourite moments, from Eurovision's hits and misses to Korean robot festivals, and further along to books about snails.
Snails will just get run a mile, well, not run a mile, but they'll get a mile away very quickly.
Well, no, they won't do it very quickly either. They'll do it really very slowly.
So there's lots to sit back and enjoy this festive season here on The Review on Monocle 24. Well, 2013 started well on The Review with some heated debate on a blockbuster exhibition opening right here in London. In January, the Royal Academy staged a Manet exhibition, the first ever to focus on his portraits. It prompted enormous queues forming around the block of hungry art lovers desperate to get a peek. On hand to share their opinions the day the doors opened to the public were regular Monocle contributor and friend Peter York and Rachel Campbell-Johnson, art critic for The Times newspaper. They spoke to Monocle's Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds.
It's such an amazing show to have, because if you think about these paintings, they are the crux of their collections that they're in all over the world, and people don't want to lend them, because if you're talking about the change from grand academic traditions to modernism, Manet is the bridge. So it is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together, and it's incredibly ambitious and fantastic that the Royal Academy's got it. On his death, Manet left something like 430 oil paintings, for the sake of argument, about half of which were portraits or genre works with strong portrait elements. And this is the first show which makes this portraiture the focus. It's slightly misleading in that you could argue that pretty much every picture Manet does with people in it is a portrait. But it's looking at the society, very emphatically, at the society in which Manet lived. This is taking the spectator back to the days when Paris, under the supervision of Baron Haussmann, was undergoing that total overhaul that would transform it from a fundamentally medieval city to a sort of bravura stage set, perhaps, on which Baudelaire's Vie Moderne could be strutted. And here we are taken into the soiree. Here we are meeting his friends and his family, the radical politicians, the great writers of the day. So it's like really being at a party, at a very haute bourgeois party in Manet's era.
Peter, were you captivated by this party mood?
Well, I'm all on for haute bourgeois parties, and I go to a lot of them, and I didn't get enough of it from this exhibition, which seemed sort of billed as a blockbuster, but seemed rather thin. It was literally sort of thinly hung and rather oddly hung, and I wanted to be told, as a pleb, what Manet's claims for being king of the modern world and the Great Bridge, and I didn't think I got it.
Do you think there was a bit too much presumed knowledge here?
There was certainly too much presumed knowledge. And that wonderful bit of curator speak, unresolved. Unresolved means not finished.
That was Peter York and Rachel Campbell-Johnson debating with Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds back in January. Some of our favourite reviews from across the year have been about film, and our roster of articulate and charming critics continues to grow. We easily could have filled a whole show with their entertaining insights, and looking to the year ahead, we're aiming for a fortnightly dedicated film slot here on The Review. So, movie lovers, do keep listening in. As this year comes to a close, it was hard to put a highlight show together without focusing on the biggest film event of them all. In May, Karen Krzanovich joined me and Andrew Muller, fresh from the Quasette in Cannes, to give her take on this year's festival offerings.
Oh gosh, people were complaining about the rain. It rains every year. You go there thinking, oh, it's going to be, it's going to be just wonderful. I'm going to go on that beach, because you never do, really. You're going to bring all your great shoes and your terrific clothes because you want to look glamorous, and then everything gets ruined. It was absolutely torrential. I mean, the soaking of the carpets and people just not wanting to go out. But that's standard. So, yeah, people were just shocked because that's not what they wanted. Why?
I know, but for the promoters of Gatsby, like, they must have invested millions. Yeah, and in their head must shocking. Have been this glamorous Riviera premiere. And it was puddles.
Yes, it was very, very bad. And, of course, we had some wardrobe malfunctions with people trying to keep their clothing out of the water. But never mind. All makes for column inches.
Aside from the weather, which just sounds like it was in London.
Yes.
You might as well have just like stayed here and stuck a DVD on, really.
Absolutely.
What were the films actually any good? What were the films that were any good? I'm assuming some weren't.
Yeah. I mean, Cannes, above all, really makes you realize how very, very different people's tastes are in film. Your best friend will be there seeing exactly the same film. You will hate it. They will love it. And you begin to think, why am I friends with you?
What the hell is wrong with you people?
Exactly. What's wrong? And then you'll see something in Cannes which you will love because you'll be lifted by the sheer fatigue of the whole festival. This is my film of the year so far. I know it's only May. Is Behind the Candelabra, which is Steven Soderbergh's. He couldn't get this film financed in Hollywood. Went to HBO. HBO threw some money at him. What he wanted. He got Michael Douglas to play Liberace. And Matt Damon to play Scott, his lover. And people are saying, well, you know, young people aren't going to know who Liberace is. You don't need to know.
Matter.
It's such an astonishing story. It's almost like fiction. And the fact that I'm old enough to have seen Liberace alive, it's now transcended into the perfect fiction. This man owned a world record fur cape that had its own car. And that's real.
That's probably one of those indications that you're making that little bit too much money, isn't it?
Yes, but you know, back then,
when you have a car for items of your wardrobe,
nobody cared. Nobody cared if a very, very wealthy bachelor who was dating Sonia Henning needed that sort of thing for his showmanship.
That was Karen Krzanovich talking to me and Andrew Muller back in May. Another review regular who's never scared to give his opinion, and this is mandatory on our show, is Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune. Matt's been keeping us up to date all year long on Broadway's hits and misses. After a bumper Broadway session, having soaked up 13 productions in New York in a matter of days, he dropped by to share his analysis on this year's Tony nominations with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
It's all got very sort of full of inspirational uplift and songs with titles like Everybody Say Yeah, Raise You Up, Hold Me in Your Heart.
It may just be me, but there is almost nothing in this world I find more depressing than inspirational uplift.
Well, in order to depress you even further, let's have a listen to Everybody Say Yeah.
Price and Sons spent the last century making a range of shoes for men. We will begin this century making a range of shoes for a range of men.
Andrew's just had a heart attack later.
It sounds like the thing that a kind of entire field full of people sing just before someone starts ladling out the Kool-Aid.
Well, Sondheim it ain't, that's for sure. It sort of turns the Al Hirschfeld Theater on 45th Street into a clapathon, as you can tell. And the score is by Cyndi Lauper, of course, who is not known
Imagine
for...
Imagine my surprise.
Yeah, quite. Not known for her Broadway work, but of course is very successful in other fields. And if she wins on June 9th, she'll be the first ever woman to win for her composing lyricist skills on Broadway.
There's something that I always think when you have a very, very uplifting piece of theatre that suddenly grabs the attention of the world. I'm thinking of Mamma Mia as well in the cinema. I always wonder whether a recession will often prompt something like this, that there is a real need for a sort of instant hit of feel-good sugariness.
I think that's right. I mean, what this musical traffics in is absolute and total gratification, often at the expense of common sense. Well, one of the big differences...
That's never stopped anybody before. Yeah.
I mean, the movie, as I remember it from 7, 8 years ago, whenever it was, at least held together as a coherent narrative. This actually makes no sense at all, because it's all about getting the narrative to the point of this spurious uplift so that the audience goes out grinning.
What's the plot?
The plot is basically a guy in Northampton whose father has died. He runs a shoe factory. The son inherits the shoe factory, although it's probably not what he would have wanted to do, left to his own devices. And the shoe factory has fallen on hard times, but he discovers that there's a market in peddling kinky boots, i.e. shoes for a range of men, cross-dressers, transvestites, and so on. And he strikes up a friendship with Lola, who's a local transvestite, played, I must say, wonderfully by Billy Porter. And Billy Porter will be the main competition for Matilda's Bertie Carvel when it comes to Best Actor in a Musical.
That was Matt Wolff talking to Emma Nelson and Angie Muller on The Review back in May. You're listening to a special edition of The Review, a look back at our favourite moments from 2013. Well, no review show is complete without a musical guest. And this year we have truly taken a journey through nearly every genre via every corner of the globe. There were so many highlights to choose from, and we've spliced together a selection here for you to enjoy, from Australian pop to Peruvian psychedelia via Americana and K-pop. Here now are some of our favourite guests from the last year.
And that track was called I Got a Feeling by Chung King, a three-piece formed in Brighton, and the choice of today's guest reviewer, Joe Muggs, a journalist and talent scout. Joe, why did you choose to bring that track into us today?
This one was not a difficult decision. I actually used to be in Chung King. So
shameless.
Completely shameless.
You love them.
But, I mean, I'm talking over 10 years ago, a very early lineup.
Are you trying to get back into the group?
In Oslo, we have a bell tower, which is a pretty vital point of contact for Oslo as a city as well. It's located on top of the city hall, and it sort of resonates throughout the city. So whenever you are in the city, each hour you hear a little bell concert. So it's bells is something growing up in Oslo you have a pretty strong relationship to, and a conscious relationship to, because yeah, just hear it all the bloody time.
And South Korea, they do like their girl bands, and it seems that, you know, where we're used to girl bands of four, they seem to multiply there. So it's almost like a big orchestral chorus of girls and girl bands in South Korea.
I mean, the Wonder Girls, they've got about 10 members, you know, and they have these subgroups and things that'll split off and do these solo projects, and then they all reunite and get back together, you know. It's again, it's this sort of sense of acceleration, you know, where a band will break up and then reunite for the comeback tour within the space of a couple of years, you know.
I think that's the thing for women, is about asking questions, not being frightened to sort of learn, because it's not something you're necessarily taught. And, you know, if you think about the first computer you had, most boys would have had a ZX Spectrum. I had one for some reason, you know, but I don't think many girls would have said on their Christmas list, I would like a toy computer.
Thank you.
I've been a collector of vinyl since I was 15 years old. I always go back to Peru and just scour the record shops and sort of collectors and find collectors, you know, guys that are in the depths of Lima or other cities, you know, just hiding their record collections away from the world and don't think that their vinyl is worth anything. To me, it is. To many people, it isn't. But I love old music, vintage music. So I thought, why not start re-releasing some of this? Some of it that's hard to find. Some people might not know much about it, but let's do that. But also work with new artists that we love. So that's sort of coming up in the future.
You know, the Norwegian sound is sort of best typified, you know, the kind of cliche is to say Jan Garbarek, the saxophone player, who has the Nordic tone, which is this sort of very austere kind of, you know, sparkling kind of clean tone that evokes the fjords and all this beautiful landscape, right?
And Edvard Munch.
It's not, you know, it's not a million miles from Edvard Munch and all that, exactly. Not always screaming, mind you.
Mike, I'm riveting. You make me desperate to hear what Nordic jazz sounds like. So should we hear a track from, this is someone who's going to be playing at the Oslo Jazz Festival.
That's right. This is a lady called, well, it's a band called Beady Bell. The singer is called Beate Lek. She's brilliant. They've been going for a while. She's a good example of the kind of the way the Norwegian jazz sound has evolved.
I came to your rescue, took you out of this place where there's neither patience nor pity. Nothing will last. Nobody stays in this fleet.
I think that everybody sort of knows the words to My Old Kentucky Home in the same way that people know the beginning of the Gettysburg Address, or they kind of know like the Pledge of Allegiance or something like that. But yeah, it's a huge traditional part of the whole ceremony.
That was My Old Kentucky Home, as played at last year's Kentucky Derby by the University of Louisville's marching band. That's the song that the horses appear to.
Yeah, when they come out onto the field, they all walk out to My Old Kentucky Home, which I didn't realize that every year is played by the University of Louisville marching band.
What's the first track you've chosen for us?
Well, the first track is by Frankie Valli, and he's quite a mainstream chap, and I've learned over the years that you have to explore. And I came to Frankie Valli, the first track that I kind of went, oh yeah, actually that's quite good, was the cheesy Oh What a Night. That was late December back in 63.
Yeah.
And then I found The Night, which is a fantastic Northern Soul stomper. And then they did Paluski, the Paris DJ, did an edit of Begging. And I thought, okay, three killers. There must be more. So I went looking and I found this.
Oh, makes me tell you, oh girl. Yeah. You know you're gonna hurt yourself. Hey. You know you're gonna hurt yourself when you're broken, worn out. When your heart is torn.
Yeah, I've had to go right into that kind of devil's area of West Coast MOR to find the nuggets. And I think this is one, but it's right on the edge of the cheese. Because it's Rupert Holmes, whose big hit is the Pina Colada song. Yeah. You like Pina Colada? I'm going to walk in the rain.
I was about to say, I feel basically, this sounds like you should have your smart jacket on, maybe in a pastel shade with the sleeves rolled up.
Absolutely. Just imagine me like that, listeners, as we give you, off the same album of the Pina Colada song, this is Rupert Holmes with Answering Machine.
And I said, baby, let's go get married. I need to know your mind. I am hanging on, I am hanging on, I am hanging on this line. And if I can leave one message before you go to bed, I would say to you, and the phone went dead.
I mean, I think you obviously have the Country Music Awards that celebrates the Toby Keiths and the Taylor Swifts. The Americanas, particularly, it starts with an award show in the Ryman Auditorium, the sort of home of country and the home, the sort of Nashville, center of Nashville music. And it celebrates people like Emmylou Harris played on that show at that award ceremony. And then they'll bring in the sort of Dr. Johns, Dan Auerbach played with him. So there's quite an interesting, Americanas are very broad. These guys were a nominee for new artist at the Americana Awards. And these guys are sort of modern day Simon and Garfunkel. I think they're from LA, and the song is called Honey, Honey.
Heard
she takes a lover, and vice God only knows. Sister, won't you, sister, please let your sister go.
Never scared to branch into new genres. Here on The Review, that was Crispin Perry reporting back on this year's Americana Music Conference, fresh off a plane from Nashville, right here on The Review. There's more to come on the special end-of-year compilation. After this short break, we'll be enjoying some more of our favourite guests from the last 12 months. Stay tuned.
The Weekend Edition is the perfect way to wind down from your working week and prepare for the days ahead. Every Saturday and Sunday, we bring you a mix of new music, global front pages, insightful interviews, and lively guests.
He just gets better and better. He's really terribly good. And so it's absolutely aggravating and brilliant, of course.
There's also the usual eclectic mix of Monocle 24 programming, a look back at a few broadcasting highlights, and a preview of some of the shows to come.
This is a film that took 3 years to make. We traveled to 10 countries. There's over 20 different stories in the film about people interacting in one way or another. The scope of it is pretty massive.
That's The Weekend Edition with me, Georgina Godwin. All day Saturday from 8 a.m. and on Sundays from 1600 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
One of my highlights from the past year here in London was back in February when I found it hard to contain my excitement at the long-awaited revival of a Broadway classic, A Chorus Line. It was an instant smash hit when it first opened in 1975, and I was keen to see whether this reawakening would capture the imagination of a new generation. Donald Hutera, dance and theatre critic for the Times newspaper, was also practising his dance moves and jazz hands for the opening night, and he joined me and Emma Nelson in the studio to give us his verdict.
Keeping brilliant time to that is Donald Hutera, dance and theatre critic for the Times newspaper. He was at the premiere on Wednesday night. Welcome, Donald. Still on cloud nine?
I am. Hearing that music, it's hard not to get up and dance. And the show made me want to dance at the end, if not during the middle of it.
I think everyone in the theatre was tapping their feet and turning their shoulders to the tune of the music and tipping their imaginary hats.
But what I love about it is how emotional it is and how it shows how merciless the magic can be of show business.
That's a good way to put it.
The two things together, it's so cruel in some ways for these hoofers, these Broadway gypsies, who Cassie says, the lead female, she says, it would be nice to be a star, but I'm not. I'm a dancer. And I love that little beat, you know, but I'm not. Wait. I'm a dancer. It's a timepiece, but it's a timepiece that is still, I don't know, relevant. It's still inspiring. Yeah. It's human. It's so human. And the glitz of it is so simple and a bit raw as well. And I think it works really brilliantly, and the cast is wonderful. And when Victoria Hamilton Barrett sings a song called Nothing, which is about a Stanislavskian acting class that she just didn't feel whatever she was meant to feel. She felt nothing. She's, you know, it's her star turn. She's terrific, by the way, but many of them are terrific. And as a collective, they're really a wonderful bunch. Now, I've got two tiny criticisms of it, but it's okay to have that. I still love it.
I'm not going to hit you.
It sounds like a good marriage, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. One is that I'm not sure that the final eight who get selected, they're actually pretty imbalanced, if you really think about it. If it's all supposed to be uniform But it doesn't matter.
Imbalanced as people, well, human
as people,
beings.
As say, shape, sizes, etc. Just a little bit. That was a tiny little niggling thing.
And is that because of the way that it is cast or inherent to the production itself, given the fact that the characters are all so different?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I actually don't know why, but I was thinking about that afterwards, that I don't think... If it was about casting eight people to be in the background supporting the star of a show we never see or don't know except for the song One... then, you know, why would you pick those people? They just, I thought about that afterwards. Mm. But it didn't matter because I loved the ones they picked and I felt sorry for the ones that they didn't pick. You know, I was with them the whole way.
That was Donald Hutera, dance and theatre critic for The Times newspaper, talking to me and Emma Nelson back in February. As much as we like to cover the big talking points here on The Review, it's always a nice feeling when we uncover something a little more unknown and intriguing as well. Over the past year, journalist Mark Mason, one of our great regular book reviewers, has recommended some excellent reads for us from around the world, which have caught his eye. But he really did have to go digging around for one particular appearance back in May. He joined myself and Andrew Muller to explain why two garden creatures, the bee and the snail, both the topics of two new books, were worth reading about.
I came across them because I was reviewing them, both for a magazine, and they came sort of roughly the same, you know, within a couple of months of each other. And they struck me, they were very similar in that they're written by non-scientists. Well, I mean, one of the, Dave Goulson, the bee guy, is an acknowledged bee expert now. But he starts off by saying how he started getting interested in them as a kid. Very similar to Ruth Brooks, who's the snail author. And she's a complete amateur, although she's gone on to enter amateur science competitions. Because like you, she has problems with her snails. And she tried everything to get rid of them. Coffee grounds, apparently she heard, were the...
It's impossible.
Absolute anathema to snails. Snails will just get a mile away very quickly.
they won't do it very quickly either. They'll do it really very slowly.
Do you know what? One of the details in her book, and I've just worked out an exclusive Monocle statistic here. We can wow the world with this. This has never been worked out before.
General.
She finds out that the world snail speed record is held by Archie at 0.05 miles an hour, which I have just worked out for you is exactly 1/540th of Usain Bolt's top speed.
That may be the least impressive world record ever set. It is the contrast between the two books is interesting, and they're both lovely and passionate books. But I mentioned in the setup there that you tend to end up dividing the creatures in your garden, the ones you want and the ones you don't.
Yeah.
Snails tend to get a fairly bad press, whereas everybody loves bumblebees. I suppose the one thing we could call, I mean, the really interesting one, if someone was actually to write a book trying to make a case for wasps, that would be an interesting heresy, because everybody hates wasps, which are basically the football hooligans of the insect world. But we'll start with the snails. But what does Ruth Brooks like about snails, and what does she discover about
them? What's great about the book is that she started off, as you say, hating them. Like everyone, they just eat through all her delphiniums, and she tries everything to get rid of them. But she realises in the end that they are lovable creatures, and what really gets her attention is that, I mean, she still wants to keep them away from her flowers, but she realises that they've got incredible abilities. They home like pigeons. Everyone knows that
this was news.
Home.
This was news to me. The homing
explain
snail.
Explain this.
She
explain
notices
how...
that they keep coming back to the same place from no matter how far away she takes them. And she takes them hundreds of yards from house, across major roads, across through forests. There's
and
no way they can get through.
The shells with different colour nail varnish so she can varnish. Tell they're her snails.
This is how she ends up. On BBC Radio, they run an amateur scientist competition. And she ends up entering that and wins it because of these efforts she's made to paint nail varnish on the shelves.
You would need to be an extraordinarily patient researcher, wouldn't you? This is not one of those experiments that's going to reap instant benefit.
It isn't, but it's also
it's like I'm going to take a snail 200 yards over there, and now I wait.
And they don't know how bees do it. They're still mystified. The bee guy will tell you that they don't know how bees will home the equivalent of four trips to the moon in human terms, and they don't know how they do it. They do a waggle dance. They know about the waggle dance, which is where they as the bee is flying back to the hive from a brilliant source of flowers, a brilliant source of pollen, hundreds of yards away, miles away. When it meets someone from its own hive who's on its way out, it will do a little dance and it waggle its bottom in the direction of the flowers. And the number of times it waggles its bottom equates to how far away those flowers are. They're incredible creatures.
I think what I find interesting is both these books kind of celebrate our kind of longing for the slow life. Everything's so fast. And I just find, you know, when my head is so full of noise, I sit out in my little kind of terrace garden with my coffee or my glass of wine. And I do watch the snails slowly move. And there's this sort of intrigue in the... and fascination into these creatures.
But and then you look into them. That's how Ruth Brooks started, exactly the same, as a gardener. Mm-hmm. And she gets into them and then finds out incredible things about them. Like they're hermaphrodites. I didn't know that. Snails are... And the mating... Well, I won't go into the details now because it'd take too long and slightly indelicate. But just snails mating is just unbelievable. And they're deaf. Snails are deaf. And in South Korea, their mucus...
That's why they don't move when I shout at them.
Hey! Now it's making sense. And in South Korea, they use snail mucus to make face cream.
Maybe that's what I should do with my snails in my garden.
I think there is a process for us. Don't just pick the snail up and rub it. But she also finds out that that mucus is absolutely incredible in terms of, she puts an absolute razor-sharp knife down to try and discourage them. And the snail can go up one side of the knife, over the very, very razor-sharp edge with its mucus protecting it, and then down the other side. Unbelievable creatures.
That was Mark Mason talking to me and Andrew Muller back in May. This is a special edition of The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, where we're looking back at some of the highlights from the show from the past 12 months. Every week on The Review, we've brought you recommendations from various cities around the world, courtesy of our Toronto bureau chief, Nelly Gotcheva, and our army of international reporters. It's been a fun way of exploring what's happening on the cultural calendar around the globe, and here's a little taster of the range of events we've brought to your attention.
This weekend in Florence, step into an exhibition dedicated to Salvador Dali. Palazzo Medici Riccardi welcomes a collection of Dali's lesser-known works, including surrealist furniture, bronze and glass sculptures, plus illustrations depicting sensual scenes from novels by the likes of Dante and Boccaccio. Featuring over 100 works, the exhibit is in Florence until the 25th of May.
It's the beginning of a new year, and in Japan, that means sumo and kabuki. The January Grand Sumo Tournament gets underway on Sunday the 13th, the first of six tournaments this year. The January contest runs for 15 days in Tokyo and will feature the two yokozuna, or grand champions, Hakuho and Haruma Fuji. Also not to be missed is this month's New Year Kabuki performance. It features the young and popular Ebizo Ichikawa, who leads a cast in The Encounter of the Soga Brothers and Their Father's Killer, as well as other acts at Asakusa Public Hall through January 27.
With the annual celebration of Mardi Gras coming up on Tuesday, it seems fitting that we drop by and listen to New Orleans jazz legend Kermit Ruffins, who'll be playing Saturday evening at Le Poisson Rouge in Manhattan. The talented Crescent City trumpeter will be joined on stage with the ever-skilled barbecue swingers for a rare New York performance. The traditional Southern Jazz Quintet takes to the stage at 8:30 for a big night of New Orleans boogie music. This weekend also marks the release of The Man Who Died in His Boat by Portland-based Grouper, known also as Liz Harris. Grouper's emotive new album represents a bold follow-up to her breakthrough release, inventively titled Dragging a Dead Deer Up a Hill. All strange titles aside, it's just the sort of music to keep you cozy on a snowy New York weekend.
Spring is in the air, and Istanbul is flexing its cultural muscles. From film festivals to art openings, the city is broadcasting its well-deserved pedigree as a powerhouse of regional culture on the banks of the Bosphorus. The Istanbul Film Festival, Turkey's premier cinema event, enters its last week with a diverse schedule of international and Turkish films on offer. Renowned Mexican director Carlos Rigades will be in town for a retrospective of his work and a masterclass at the Perry Museum on the 9th of April. Be sure to catch Asle Özge's outstanding ode to Istanbul and hit among festival goers, Lifelong. The film is screening throughout the week.
Erkekler kendilerini nasıl bulunma sim kumaşı sanıyorlar yani.
If dark movie theaters have you pining for spring weather, stroll down to the Topani Art Walk on Sunday afternoon. Forming the backbone of this emerging district on the European side, a mix of contemporary art galleries and museums will open their doors, creating the perfect atmosphere to sample Istanbul's understated art scene. Be sure to drop by the Depot Gallery for Mathieu Poisson's latest collection of drawings, exploring the little-known and long-forgotten corners of the city.
Sao Paulo may not have Rio's reputation for leisure and fun, but Brazil's business city is brimming with culture. With some of the nation's best galleries, live music venues that range in specialty from rock to samba, and even a pretty decent stock of great architecture. If you find yourself here in Sao Paulo this weekend, here's what Monocle suggests. The annual BMW Jazz Festival kicked off on Thursday, taking place at venues across the city. The festival's top bill came in the form of 20-time Grammy-winning guitar virtuoso Pat Metheny. But if you missed it, fear not, he'll be back on Sunday to close the festival with a free open-air concert at the Oscar Niemeyer-designed Auditorio Ibirapuera.
You are in for a treat if you are heading to Helsinki this weekend. Even though the Finnish climate can be unpredictable, the bright and long evenings mean that you'll feel more energized than you have for a long time. This is one of the busiest weekends in the Finnish capital this summer, and there are as many as three major festivals to choose from. You may well enjoy Baseline Festival, showcasing the best new music Finland has to offer, ranging from disco to rap, jazz and soul. Or maybe you want to see what Helsinki Pride has to offer. Saturday has the big parade, and both Saturday and Sunday evening see quite a few parties around central Helsinki. Don't be surprised if you see loads of men dressed up as brides. They all just really liked this year's Finnish Eurovision entry called Marry Me.
A taster there of our global look-aheads from the last 52 weeks of the review, from Tokyo to Toronto via Perth, São Paulo, Istanbul, New York, Helsinki and Seoul. I'm Gillian DeBias and I'll be bringing you some more highlights from the review 2013, including our Eurovision special, just after the break.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back. This is the best of the review on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, where we're taking a look back at the past year to share some of our favourite moments with you. We're running out of time, but we have just a little more space to hear a few more special highlights. We start in March when Emma Nelson and I were joined in studio by Carol Corm, Monocle's Beirut correspondent and also founder of her own publishing house, Daria Press. It was a pleasure to speak to her about writing from the region as she shared with us some of her favourite new authors.
I think also as a journalist, people are a little bit tired of the kind of macho, seasoned Middle Eastern or big reporter that wants to tell you how brave he is. And these books that I picked out, they kind of explain the Middle East through another angle, whether it's a personal story, whether it's through food, whether it's through going after your ancestors. And they're all, I mean, they all sum up the situation in the Middle East, which is super complicated, where people are tired of hearing about it. I, as a Middle Easterner, I'm tired, so I can understand Europeans must be very sick of it. And so the first book is Nahla Ayed's A Thousand Farewells, who's a Canadian reporter, and she wrote the story of her career and her life, which is really incredible, because she started off in Winnipeg, and then her parents, who are Palestinian, thought that she and her brothers and sisters should kind of know their culture, so they sent them back to Amman, and they lived in a refugee camp for 7 years. I mean, it's pretty tough. So I was reading that.
I spoke to her a few months ago when she came into the studio to talk to us about it, and I said, how do you feel towards your mum and dad as a result of that? And she said, yeah, it was quite complicated
at the time,
you know, because she'd gone from a very, and the book beautifully explores the fact that she'd gone from this very amazing, lovely, normal Western life to suddenly finding themselves without any of the structures around them that had survived, that had surrounded their childhood.
I think people are a little bit tired of that whole macho view on things. Or also there's this other strain of all this, like, books about sexuality and women in the Middle East. It's like that's all there is, the hijab and sexual, and the girl that was married when she was 14. And I mean, this is true and it exists and it's terrible, but I find in Europe you kind of get those two big currents. Either it's the macho journalist or it's the stories about the girls that were abused. So Nahla's book is great because, first of all, she sums up like really complicated issues in one sentence. You get it. And she's smart, she's witty, she's not pretentious. It's a pleasure to read.
That was Carol Corm talking to me and Emma Nelson back in March. Now, the rise of Netflix has been a huge story this year and something we've covered regularly on the programme. But the US cable networks have been fighting back and presented a roster of various new series this autumn. We invited Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast Magazine, into the studio in September to give us his take on some of the new offerings.
TV's taken over film. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the last couple of years, whether it's movie stars moving into TV, whether it's the writers, the directors, the producers, TV has sort of taken to the point now where it feels like it's bigger than the movie business.
And yet, can television still dominate the discourse in the way it once did? Will there ever be, say, if you're talking in terms of launching either drama or comedy, another program like MASH, or even indeed more recently Friends, that unites the discourse as those programs did?
You might not get the same numbers as MASH did or the finale of Friends did, but I mean, I haven't met a person in the last 2 weeks who hasn't talked about the finale of Breaking Bad. Mm. So you do get these shows, and perhaps, you know, they're not necessarily as the same numbers, but they are still huge. I mean, you look at the numbers that watched Big Bang Theory, you know, whether you like that as a show or not, that's 20 million people. That's
true
still
enough.
Big numbers.
But a program like Breaking Bad, I wonder, is that a repeat of the phenomenon that we saw with The Wire, where it got incredible amounts of press because journalists were obsessed with it, but not actually that many people in the real world were watching?
I think people didn't watch it to start with. I think it started very slowly, but I think thanks to Netflix and, you know, illegal downloads and box sets, more people. I mean, you look at the numbers in the States, and every single week that grows, and they're getting a lot more viewers now. I think it just took a while because it wasn't the most accessible show around.
So how competitive is it? Can you give us a sense of, like, does this make or break networks?
It's mental. It's absolutely mental. You look at NBC because you talked about shows like Friends. I mean, if you can remember during the 90s, you had these huge hits on NBC, whether it was Friends and Will and Grace and such. And now NBC is the smaller of the four networks, although they're trying to sort of help that. And, you know, they're trying to go through slightly broader shows than perhaps they've done in the last few years, because they've had things like Parks and Recreation and The Office, which have been relatively niche shows. So for this year, for instance, I mean, their big bet is a show called The Blacklist, which is with James Spader, and it's a very traditional crime drama. But you look at the numbers, it launched last week, and there's 30 million people watching it. So it is very, very competitive.
That was Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast Magazine, talking to me and Andrew Muller back in September. We've covered numerous art exhibitions on The Review, both in London and around the world, and one of our regular and most articulate London critics is Ben Luke from London's Evening Standard newspaper. The annual Frieze Art Fair descended on the city in October, and we asked Ben to talk us through some of the international artists and galleries on display. He stopped by to talk to Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
First of all, you've got to see the Jeff Koons show on the Gagosian stand, because it's the thing that everybody's talking about. It's the thing that's really got everybody moving. Jeff Koons is probably the most divisive figure in the art world. He's regarded as an absolute god by many in the art world. He's regarded as the epitome of bling and the moneyed art elite by others. So Gagosian has a stand, and it features four sculptures and a single painting, all of which are worth multi-million pounds. So
and you are absolutely aware of that due to the presence of the high level of security when you're going past it. And I just, you thought, hang on a minute, does the security guard come with the big wrapped heart that's yes. worth goodness knows how many millions and what have you? You just think this is a very, very cleverly crafted thing that you actually create. You actually create an installation out of creating the installation.
Well, precisely. I mean, it really does look like a satire. If you look at it, it's so big, burly security guards standing by major artworks, which actually are, for instance, an inflatable lobster, but made from aluminium, a wrapped up candy heart, you know, a kitten in a clothesline bag, hanging off a clothesline with
very
sort of with
kitten.
Flowers.
Yeah,
enormous, ultimate ultra kitsch, but made, you know, the whole thing about Koons's work is made incredibly beautifully and handcrafted beautifully. And it's beautifully installed. You know, it looks extraordinarily professional. It looks like an exhibition rather than an art fair booth. My favourite section of Frieze London, the contemporary fair, is the frame section, which is actually where you have emerging galleries from all over the world showing single artists. So because they're booths dedicated to one artist, they have a coherence and a kind of consistency that you might not get on the more checkered booths that are presented by other galleries where they have one work by loads of their artists and it's all a bit hodgepodge. In the frame section, you really do get a sense of emerging art from around the world. And I love that section. There's a work by a very, very interesting London artist, a guy called Prem Sahib, and he's created this white cube which is to the dimensions of his sort of teenage bedroom. And from within it, you hear this sort of pumping house music. Outside of it, you've got the kind of ropes that you might find outside a nightclub. And then on the wall, you have this, what looks like a sweaty mirror, but it's actually immaculately produced, through each bead of sweat produced in resin on this aluminium panel. So it's sort of like an abstract work of abstraction or minimalism, but given this sort of sense of the body in front of it. And I love that stand. It was a really thoughtful stand. It was about teenage idealism, about the desire of a teenager in his bedroom to go out into the wide world and to experience exciting things, you know. And so little things like that. And then there's another which was an enormous, what looked like a rock made from black aluminium foil, which was hung by a sort of rope, and you would walk directly beneath it and it looked like it was going to crush you, and next to it was this drawing with a rope drawn in pencil very, very beautifully, and it was just this one tiny thread which was keeping that rope together, and you connected the two, and there was this lovely sense of drawing and sculpture working together and really involving the audience. So in frame, that's what I would advise people to do. Go to frame, see emerging art, and you do get a sense of things that you actually couldn't see anywhere else in the world.
That was Ben Luke giving Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller the lowdown on Frieze back in October. And finally, one event which would have been impossible for us to ignore this year and in this Best of the Best compilation show was the annual Eurovision Song Contest. It's a fascinating game of geopolitical diplomacy as much as it is a glamorous singing contest, and something we always love to follow here at Monocle. But no one loves it more than our very own Review researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. In May, we dispatched him to Malmo for this year's final, and he joined us via ISDN from the venue just hours before the big night to talk to me and Hugo MacDonald.
Oh, I'm extremely excited. You know, yesterday I've watched the dress rehearsal, so I kind of know how the final will be, but apparently there will be a surprise in the end, which not even us journalists were allowed to see. So,
and any inkling on what the surprise would be?
Oh, well, there's some rumors. I'm afraid to say that, but apparently there's some rumors that maybe ABBA will sing in the end. But again, those are just rumors. But if it happens, I'm going to be the happiest man in the world.
Is this your dream assignment, Fernando?
Exactly, that's my dream assignment. And you know, ABBA, they just opened their museum in Stockholm a few days ago, so it would be perfect timing, no?
Well, Fernando, we mentioned in the introduction that Denmark is the favourite. Let's have a little listen. Only Teardrops there by Emily DeForest, which is Denmark's entry and the favourite. Fernando, it's a word on the ground that it's a done deal. Is Denmark going to walk home?
I do think so, Hugo. I mean, as I said yesterday, I believe there's 80% of chance of this song to win. But, you know, I'm open for surprises. I have to say that's not my favourite song because I think Emily DeForest is kind of playing too safe in the song, if I can say that. But, you know, it's not a bad song. But I like the beat in the end where she become a little bit like Shakira, Whenever, Wherever, you know. But the beginning is a bit too boring, in my opinion. But, you know, maybe next year I'll be just right there in Copenhagen, 20 minutes from here.
The thing about the Eurovision Song Contest, one sense, is it doesn't really matter how good the song is or how bad it is, because it's all politics and you have various nations, you know, backing each other. Do you get a sense that behind the scenes there are political negotiations going on in terms of wheeling and dealing and negotiation for to win?
Well, absolutely, but I think they're trying to fix this problem because I believe since last year they reintroduced the jury voting. So now 50% of the vote is by the public and the other 50% by a special jury in each country. So I think this kind of geopolitical, voting that everybody was complaining about it, I think this is not a big problem as it was like 2 years ago. So which is better, otherwise it becomes too boring, you know, if you know every time that, you know, Sweden's going to vote for Norway and, I don't know, Romania is going to vote for Bulgaria or something
no
like that.
No one votes for the British entry. Let's spare a little thought for Bonnie Tyler. How are people feeling about her entry?
I don't think she will get new points because she's, I was talking to a journalist here, she's so friendly. If you see an interview with her, she has this kind of raspy laugh. I kind of love her and everybody respects her. I mean, come on, who doesn't love Total Eclipse of the Heart?
That was our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to me and Hugo MacDonald from the Eurovision Song Contest back in May. Well, that's all we've got time for on this highlight show. We hope you've enjoyed looking back over the last year here on The Review on Monocle 24. To end the show, let's hear from the winner of this year's Eurovision, Emilie DeForest from Denmark, with her song, Only Teardrops. Don't forget, you can still listen to each and every past episode of The Review and any of our other Monocle 24 programmes through the radio tab at monocle.com or on iTunes. Thanks for listening over the past 12 months and remember there's lots more to come in the year ahead. I'm Gillian DeBias. Enjoy the holidays.
The sky's red tonight. We're on the edge tonight. No shooting star to guide us. Eye for an eye. Why tear each other apart? Please tell me why. Why do we make it so hard? Look at us now. We only got ourselves to blame. It's such a shame. How many times can we win and lose? How many times can we break the rules between? Come and face me now, here on this stage tonight. Let's leave the past behind us. Eye for an eye, why tear each other apart? Please tell me why. Why do we make it so hard? Look at us now, we only got ourselves to blame. It's such a shame. Tell me why.